Geneva, wind chill 7 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For today's morning show is a well-known science writer by the name of Greg Brenica. It's actually not quite doing him justice to say he's a science writer. He is himself a scientist, a staff scientist and cosmochemist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And his work has been seen in all kinds of different places, including Science Magazine, Nature Magazine, and so on. And he has given the world a really fascinating new book that looks at the meteor, and specifically meteorites, when meteors strike the Earth, and what a difference meteorites through the course of our planet's history and human history, what a difference they have made. The book is titled Impact: How Rocks from Space Led to Life, Culture, and Donkey Kong. It is a work that draws upon a wide array of research and takes a long historical view of this really intriguing phenomenon. And along the way, we learn about a lot of other sort of cosmic phenomena that have been a source of wonder and probably bewilderment to human beings over the millennia. This book is published by William Morrow, again titled Impact: How Rocks from Space Led to Life, Culture, and Donkey Kong. And Greg Brenica, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yes, thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I would love to hear, first of all, just a little bit about your own fascination with the heavens and how and when and why did that start for you?
Well, actually, I would say it didn't really start until later in life. I didn't really get too interested in astronomy or really anything skyward until I was in graduate school. And actually, I started studying geology in undergraduate, and when I got to graduate school, I took a course in cosmochemistry and just really liked it, and we studied meteorites there. And that's actually how I got kind of into space, was looking at rocks that fell from space. So that's kind of how I got into it.
And maybe you've just begun to answer my next question, which is to explain what the field of cosmochemistry is and what a cosmochemist does.
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of just a fancy sounding name for a geologist who like to study the stars. So cosmochemists basically look at the chemistry of the cosmos. And in order to do that, you basically have to look at meteorites, or you know, use you know, various ground-based telescopes to do this type of stuff.
So your book, very early on, helps us kind of discern the difference between some really basic terms that we tend to kind of throw around rather carelessly, rather haphazardly. So explain the difference between asteroids and meteors and meteorites. And maybe while you're at it, maybe touch briefly on comets, because those are also talked about from time to time in your book.
Sure, absolutely. So the first three that you mentioned are basically all the same objects. Asteroids, meteors, and meteorites are basically just the same thing, only in different parts of their kind of life cycle, if you will. So asteroids are floating around in space. When they kind of break up and come through the Earth's atmosphere, that fireball is a meteor. And then when they land on Earth, they're a meteorite. So it's basically all the same object.
I think at one point you say they're different names for different times. So one object,
yes,
but it's named different things depending on, in a sense, where it is or what's happening to it or what it's doing.
Right. Yeah, and the nomenclature is confusing. I won't disagree with you. But that's what we've got. And as far as comets are actually a very different type of thing. Comets are basically large, dusty snowballs. Sometimes they're 90% water ice. So they're largely thought of as things that are orbiting the sun. Usually they form very, very distantly in our solar system. They're mostly ice, and they just kind of orbit the sun. Hmm.
So when we talk about asteroids, when we, I think about the asteroid belt, and when asteroids get mentioned or are depicted in, for instance, a Star Wars film or something, we tend to think of them as fairly sizable bodies. I mean, almost like really small planets or really small moons, but that are just kind of out there. But that is a real misunderstanding of what asteroids are, because in fact, asteroids can be actually pretty tiny. Is there any kind of parameter of size that would indicate that this is an asteroid versus this is just a small little rock floating in space, or even are those asteroids?
No, I think it's a pretty fuzzy boundary. I don't really think it matters. Logistically, it's a rock that's floating in space, whether it's gigantic and the size of, the moon, or if it's, the size of a baseball. They're basically just the rocks. Some people call them planetesimals or bolides, and there are some people that care about the nomenclature, but I think it's just kind of silly. The rocks that are floating around in space, the name doesn't really matter to me, at least.
So one of the facts that your book shares that's pretty astounding is that meteorites are striking the Earth all the time. I mean, the sense we get is that nearly every day there are meteorites of one kind or another. I mean, obviously, really, really small meteorites, but we are, in a sense, perpetually bombarded by small little meteorites. I mean, is it as much as every single day and everywhere around the planet? Are we always being hit by tiny meteorites?
Yeah, we're receiving most of our kind of, flux of meteorites in the form of dust, like you were talking about, we call micrometeorites. So they're not really seen by human beings. They just kind of end up falling, harmlessly. But we definitely get, other, fist size, and larger pieces that people see and pick up routinely. We're adding something like 80 tons of material from outer space every day. So it's happening at a pretty good clip. It certainly has sped up over time. This was much more common early in the solar system because there was a lot more stuff. It wasn't really in a stable orbit. So early in the solar system, the Earth was receiving, many magnitudes more per day of meteoritic material, but we still get quite a bit.
One thing that you talk about, this is a little later in the book, is about meteorite prospecting. And that is, there are people who really go out of their way to try to find meteorites, but that the fact that they are everywhere, that they fall so randomly, makes it really difficult for someone who wants to go out of their way to find them. It's really kind of a little tricky to kind of wrap our heads around that. On the one hand, it seems like that should make it simpler. In fact, in some ways, it makes it a little more difficult. Tell us just where we tend to find meteorites and what meteorite prospectors do in order to try to lay their hands on substantial and significant meteorites.
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty interesting career choice. I think it's there's only a few people that really prospect meteorites for a living in the world, but it's certainly an interesting choice. And like you mentioned, meteorites do fall pretty randomly around the globe. So they're not concentrated in certain areas. They fall randomly. But of course, we're not going to find them in the middle of the ocean. We're not going to find them it's really hard to find them in the middle of a rainforest. So in order to find these things, it usually has to be certain conditions that make it possible. So they look usually pretty much like a lot of normal rocks. But if you're in an area that's like a dry lake bed, a desert, something like this, where you don't have as many rocks that are sitting around, then it's easier to, you know, go find a special rock. Particularly things like Antarctica, places where there's glaciers, large white expanses, are easy to pick out these black rocks. So oftentimes people will, you know, just kind of go for a hike in, you know, let's say Arizona in a dry lake bed and just kind of look for weird stones while they're doing this. And then for meteorite prospectors that do this for a living, they actually will wait until, you know, as soon as they hear of a fireball, they will just jump on a plane and then immediately go to that location and try to locate the material. You know, because the quicker you get it after it's entered the Earth's atmosphere and landed on Earth, the more valuable it is scientifically, because it hasn't interacted with, you know, the life and, you know, kind of, it hasn't been rained on, these types of things that kind of make it more difficult to study. And, of course, it's also worth more as a collector because it's a fresh ball and people are excited by that.
When you spell out some of the places where meteorite prospectors are especially apt to go, one of the places is a plains region in southern Australia. And as you're describing this particular habitat, you also mention certain laws that are in effect in Australia that, in a sense, kind of limit who would be interested in trying to find meteorites there. Can you tell us a little bit about this region of Australia, why it's, in a sense, a good place to look for meteorites and yet also kind of a complex place to actually go prospecting?
Yeah, absolutely. So Australia, you know, is blessed with a lot of land. Some of it is very flat, and some of it is very white. And so the region you're talking about is called the Null Arbor, basically for no trees. And, you know, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a large expanse of basically limestone, which is a white rock. So there's no trees. It's a very flat area of white. So, you know, that lends itself pretty easily to picking up black rocks that came from above. But you're exactly right. In the laws of Australia, if you go hiking in the Null Arbor and find a meteorite, you're not necessarily going to be able to take it home because, you know, the laws don't allow that. So, you know, certain countries are better or worse for, you know, meteorite prospecting simply based on their laws. So, you know, other countries like Morocco, you know, have very loose laws. So a lot of people go meteorite hunting in Morocco because they also have large areas of sand and flat areas. So yeah, it's a really interesting case for Australia. So you have to be a real true meteorite hunter to go there and just do it for the science.
Right. And then you contrast that with, for instance, the Middle Eastern region of Oman. I've always had kind of an interest in Oman because I remember years ago I saw a chart of flags of the world, and Oman's flag, at least at that point in time, was just a solid red banner with absolutely nothing on it. And I remember seeing that as an elementary student thinking, Oman must be a really interesting place. And I think their flag is different now, actually. But anyway, Oman is mentioned here as also a place that, because of its topography, is a promising place to find meteorites, and thousands have been found there. And you tell us that, for instance, unlike Australia, meteorite collection is perfectly legal in Oman, and so one can find a meteorite and one can remove it from the country and sell it. Typically, what happens when one finds a meteorite in a place like Oman? What is the process like by which that passes into someone else's hands and money is exchanged? Is it basically the same way we sell just about anything else?
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, it would be akin to, you know, finding something interesting on the street and then selling it at a pawn shop. You know, Oman's actually an interesting point because one of the primary meteorite dealers has spent a lot of time collecting in Oman, and occasionally you can run into some, I guess, static when it comes to removing things from the country. I think it was, you know, his maybe 10th, 15th trip, something like that, to meteorite collect in Oman. And he actually ended up in an Omani prison for a couple months, you know, because I guess some local officials didn't want him doing what he was doing. So in most cases, it's okay in Oman, but sometimes you run into some difficulties, for sure.
Interesting. You do mention in the book that, of course, most of the Earth's surface is covered by oceans, and something you say makes it sound like when meteorites fall into the ocean, and presumably the majority of them fall into the oceans, that they are rendered, first of all, very likely not recoverable at all, and even if you recovered them, I think you imply that meteorites are essentially ruined if they fall into the ocean, ruined in terms of their scientific value. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, you're right in that it's almost impossible and unthinkable that we'd find a meteorite on the ocean floor. And if we did, then it would be very difficult to get anything out of it scientifically. I think, you know, because it's immediately going to penetrate that meteorite, it's going to start altering all of the textures of the minerals in there, all the different things that we've really prized meteorites for, their pristineness. Most of them have never been melted. A lot of this kind of pristine thing we characterize meteorites for would be completely ruined, basically, if they fell into water.
Hmm. Later in the book, you kind of touch on the whole matter of if and when or how often meteorites actually strike structures and cause damage, and how often they actually strike people. And of course, it's so interesting. Again, we're talking about such a wider range of possibilities because, of course, we're sometimes talking about meteorites that have caused gigantic craters. Sometimes we're talking about meteorites that have, for instance, caused all the dinosaurs to perish. And then we're talking about really small meteorites that, you know, could potentially fall and dent your car or whatever. But I mean, So we're talking about just this vast scale of possibilities. But when we're talking about smaller, more sort of ordinary meteorites, are there very many documented instances of damage and or injury being done?
So actually, no. There's not a lot of people being hit by meteorites, or there's one car that took a shot in the trunk. There's really not a lot of actual people being hit. There's kind of two instances for sure of which people were hit with meteorites that we've recovered that meteorite. So those we're sure about. They're very well documented. Neither of those people actually died. One of them was a very, very small meteorite that bounced off a tree first and hit a child in the head. And another was a rock that went through a house and then bounced off a radio and hit a woman in Alabama that was taking a nap. She ended up with a very large and painful-looking bruise, for sure, but she survived. So it's actually pretty common to have meteorites fall, but because, humans are pretty small spatially-wise, the chances are pretty low of actually humans getting hit.
I was struck by something mentioned in the chapter called Meteorite Mischief and Mitigation, in which you mention an event that I think a lot of us have perhaps heard of, and it is some kind of gigantic impact that occurred back in 1908 in the heart of Russia. And one of the things you tell us is that we actually know very, very little about this event, exactly what it was. That seems kind of amazing for something that was so relatively recent. But I suppose the remoteness of where this impact occurred is part of the problem. We have a few photographs that show acres and acres of flattened trees, but otherwise, a lot of mystery surrounds this particular event. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, it is a very interesting event. It's called the Tunguska event, and I think what you kind of touched on is the remoteness of the location is why we know so little about it. It is 1908, and it's the middle of Siberia, so getting there is never easy, and it was particularly not easy in 1908. And, you know, basically what probably happened, and everybody, you know, that studies this generally agrees that it was something called a meteoritic airburst. So what can happen is that as a meteorite enters, or as a meteor is flying through the atmosphere, it, you know, the gases that are contained in that meteorite expand very quickly because it's heating up. And you can have these massive bursts of energy. In this case, it was probably a very large, you know, meteor, and had a very large burst, and there's no crater associated with it. So that burst probably destroyed the meteor itself, so it became a bunch of small pieces as opposed to one large piece that landed on the ground and caused a massive crater. But it did level something like, I think, 850 square miles of forest, just completely pushed it down. The photos are absolutely remarkable. Most of the photos you see aren't even taken until about 10 or 15 years later. So it's just really a spectacularly powerful event that really kind of makes you think about, you know, what's going on in the skies.
Right. Well, and if it could happen again. And, of course, that's one thing you touch on. I mean, that is a very real, if perhaps somewhat remote, possibility.
Yeah. I mean, we actually had another one in Siberia. Again, it's a very large area. Happen in, I think, 2013. And a lot of people may be familiar with this because of all the Russian dashboard cam videos that went around YouTube, which are quite funny. But that kind of craze started with this Chelyabinsk meteorite that fell in 2013 and had a massive kind of airburst as well as an actual collection of a meteorite. So these things do happen. Hmm. They do happen indeed.
Right. And, of course, this chapter ends with kind of a semi-serious examination of potential mitigation strategies that we on Earth might undertake if, for instance, we saw through telescopes that some gigantic mass was heading for us and could do terrible damage to our planet. And this apparently is something that that scientists have seriously examined. Can you just kind of summarize the way in which scientists have studied this and kind of grappled with its consequences and potential mitigation possibilities?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we're kind of lucky in that Hollywood took this up with Armageddon and Deep Impact, and then more recently the movie Don't Look Up. But, you know, these are real things that people are thinking about. NASA has a planetary protection agency that tries to locate any Earth-crossing objects that may cause us trouble in the future. And really the mitigation strategy depends on how long we have. So, you know, just for the listeners that have seen the movie Don't Look Up, we only had 6 months or so. So your you know, mitigation strategies are very limited. You end up probably with some sort of military option, you know, which you basically try to blow the thing up or, you know, do other somewhat drastic things to it. If you've got, say, a decade, you know, which was definitely possible because these things can be predicted quite well, then there are a lot of more, you know, kind of passive things you can do. So there are ways to kind of use a spacecraft and use the gravity of the spacecraft to just slowly kind of drag it away from an Earth-crossing orbit. And this can happen over years. So it's a lot more passive, like I said, than blowing up the asteroid.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Greg Brenica, and we're talking about his book, Impact, How Rocks from Space Led to Life, Culture, and Donkey Kong. Greg Brenica touches on all facets of meteorites, and the balance of the book is actually about something that we are just now getting to, namely all that we can learn from the study of meteorites, and also the way in which meteorites have affected human history in all kinds of ways that most of us would never imagine. One of the things that you tell us about meteorites and what we can learn from them is that they are an intriguing way in which we can look back in time over, I mean, uncharted vast vistas of time, because meteorites, in a sense, show us where we and our planet came from. Explain why meteorites, in a sense, contain this kind of information.
Yeah, a lot of it goes back to the fact that meteorites haven't really changed since they formed. And I say this with some caveats. There's certainly some meteorites that we get from the surface of Mars or the Moon that are significantly younger and have undergone some geologic processing. But the vast majority of material that's in outer space, at least in the asteroid belt that we receive, hasn't ever been melted. It's very pristine. So it's basically locked in, as a witness or a time capsule, if you want to think of it that way, the formation of the solar system. And, you know, because this stuff is so pristine and hasn't changed in 4.5 billion years, it's really the only ticket for us to see what was going on with the formation of the sun and the formation of the planet. So they're incredibly, not just interesting to look at, but they're incredibly packed with scientific value that we really wouldn't have a chance of getting any other way. So that's why I guess I got into meteorites in the first place, and what makes them such a valuable tool for helping us understand not just our own solar system, but how other stellar systems form and evolve.
One thing you tell us is that it is very likely the impact of a gigantic meteorite that led to the creation of our own moon, if I remember this correctly. And of course, first of all, it's so interesting how we can look up in the night sky night after night at the moon and maybe kind of enjoy its beauty, but really never stop to think about, why is it there? Where did it come from? Explain this, I guess we would call it a theory, but a theory based on extensive research and study that, in fact, the moon may have come from some sort of impact on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah, and it is quite interesting to think, you know, people have been looking at the moon since people have existed, and it wasn't until after we brought samples back from the Apollo missions that we really kind of knew why it was there and how it formed. And there were a lot of theories, you know, maybe a capture of an asteroid, something like this. But when you are able to study the rocks themselves, the only, I guess, plausible explanation is that it formed after a massive meteorite impact. And when I say massive, I'm talking something the size of Mars that hit the early Earth very early in the solar system. And what happens is that when you have such a massive impact like that, you basically flash melt the entire planet, and you end up with kind of a rock vapor that surrounds the Earth. And that's actually what the moon condensed from, was this rock vapor that occurred after this massive impact early in the solar system.
Right.
So that's actually why we end up having the moon. And it's pretty cool to think that we just were only able to figure that out after we brought back samples from the Apollo missions.
So when we brought back material from the moon, then are you saying we find these connections that suggest this theory?
Yes, the chemical signatures and what we call isotopic signatures, getting into the science a little bit, is just kind of how we're able to make that connection. Because it, you know, the moon, we can make a lot of measurements from telescopes and observations and do a lot of calculations. But until we really had those rocks to look at and find out what their chemistry was, a lot of it was just kind of, you know, well, this theory. And then once we finally had the rocks, then it was fairly clear that that's what happened.
What is the speculation in terms of when this occurred? And are we talking about an impact that occurred before there was any life on this planet? I mean, in a sense, I'm asking what here on Earth was disrupted by this moon-creating impact?
Right. Well, it happened very early in the solar system, so we can date rocks from the moon and Earth, and we know kind of the bracket. So it's probably somewhere on the order of 150 million years after the solar system started. So we're talking, you know, 4.5 billion years ago still. So it's a long time ago. To kind of get to your second question about actually, can you remind me what the second part of the question is? I'm sorry.
The what here on Earth was disrupted by that impact?
Oh,
I mean, was there anything here to be disrupted?
So probably, you know, I think if there were any signs of life, they were completely obliterated because you have such a large impact that basically flash melts the entire planet. So, you know, whether there was life or not, it doesn't really matter. It would have been completely wiped out. What was very important, however, was that it basically reset our atmosphere. And we kind of have a twin planet in Venus. It's made up of basically the same stuff. It's pretty close to the same distance from the sun. And, you know, it kind of went on a trajectory that is completely uninhabitable right now. And what probably happened with the moon-forming impact is that it basically blew off the atmosphere that is so crushing on Venus that it can't support life and has basically the hottest surface temperature of any planet. It blew that off the early Earth. So we were able to basically hit the reset button. And that's why that moon-forming impact was so important for life to develop on Earth. So basically everything after it cooled down, you know, it had a reset of the atmosphere. So we were kind of able to kind of start over again and didn't have that crushing atmosphere that Venus had.
So if this had not occurred, most likely the Earth would very closely resemble Venus. And if we look at Venus and study it to whatever extent it's possible to study that shrouded planet, but we would, in a sense, see ourselves what the Earth would be if this great impact had not occurred uncounted millennia ago.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good way to say it. You know, our kind of evil twin brother that doesn't support life at all. You know,
fascinating, and it makes the fact that our planet is what it is that makes it something to be very, very grateful for and to not take for granted. Absolutely.
We are very lucky, yes.
You go on to say, of course, that the significance of the moon in terms of our planet and all of our lives goes beyond even what you just described in terms of just the nature of our planet. But there are other ways in which the moon is important to us, not just as a beautiful object in the sky or the target of our exploration back in the late 60s and 70s, but there are ways in which the moon affects our life, our collective lives on this planet in powerful ways that we sometimes forget. What are the most significant ways?
Well, one of the most significant is possibly even the creation of life or the kind of starting of life on Earth. And a lot of people, you know, there's obviously a lot of speculation with how this happened originally, but a lot of people suggest that the things that you need are a lot of organic molecules, and you need them concentrated, you know, in certain areas. And one of the best ways to do that is with tides. So for anybody who's been to, you know, the ocean front, you have the tides, and you end up with these tide pools. And, you know, after the tide recedes, you have these tide pools that slowly concentrate. And, you know, what's really interesting about the moon is it certainly does this now, but early in Earth history, the tides were much, much greater because the Earth was spinning faster and the moon was actually a little bit closer. So the tides are even more extreme all over the planet. So there's a lot of researchers of early life research that suggests that that's one of the major possibilities that happened to actually get life kick-started was using the tides of the moon, you know, kind of fortuitously concentrating this organic goo into these tidal pools, and maybe that's where life actually started in the first place.
Hmm. Fascinating. Later in this chapter, after you talk about this gigantic impact, you talk about other relatively large meteorites that have hit the Earth, including that meteorite that formed the famous Meteor Crater in northern Arizona, probably the most famous crater on Earth, I should think, and really quite an imposing sight. And yet you tell us that that it's actually, in the grand scheme of things, not all that large a crater, that there are even larger craters, much larger craters on Earth. They're just not the kind of craters that really are, in a sense, tourist attractions or the kind of craters where you can kind of take a picture of it and just sort of take it in. I find that just fascinating. For anybody who's been to the Meteor Crater, I mean, the very thought that this isn't all that big a crater is just sort of absurd on the surface. Explain kind of how such a thing can possibly be true.
Well, we're kind of lucky in where that actually happened and when it happened. And it is kind of the perfect venue to preserve a crater because it happened in northern Arizona, and it happened pretty recently. And because of that, it hasn't been, you know, washed away. It hasn't been degraded. It hasn't, been eroded. And because of that, we see that, and it's kind of this perfect crater, you know, and that's what we see on the moon. It's what we see kind of at Meteor Crater. But, you know, most of the craters that have happened on Earth, have been totally washed away by now because we have such, you know, vigorous erosion in most places. Arizona is not one of those places because of the amount of rainfall it gets. But, you know, some of the largest craters on Earth that are preserved are absolutely massive. You wouldn't know it unless you're a scientist looking for these things or studying these things, because it's certainly just, it's kind of filled in, torn up a little bit. It's just hard to even recognize it's a crater because of kind of how life takes over and erosion takes over so quickly.
You tell us that in the chapter called Cosmic Cinema for Early Humans, that one thing we can find through recorded history is instances when there have been phenomena in the skies that have really perhaps generated widespread panic, sometimes wars or the rise of religions. I mean, our human history has really been mightily affected by what has occurred in the skies, including dramatic solar eclipses and meteor showers and so on. One thing you tell us is that it's sometimes a little difficult to kind of find the facts when so much myth surrounds some of these events, or the ways that they are described can sometimes obscure just exactly what happened and when. Just how complicated is it to kind of understand the real impact of some of these events?
You know, it is quite difficult sometimes, because people and historians that write about this certainly, you know, take some poetic license and embellish, and, you know, they use terms like, you know, a loud noise came from the heavens, and, you know, okay, does that mean it actually came from above? Does that mean, you know, it was just a really loud noise? So there's a lot of ambiguity when it comes to some of the very old historical documents associated with these things. So it is very difficult. In some cases, we have a lot more evidence than others. You know, we have actual pieces of the stones in some cases that have fallen. You know, we have multiple documents, you know, spanning wide areas that maybe, you know, corroborate things. So, you know, it can be very difficult in certain cases. But there's no doubt that a lot of the, you know, cosmic cinema, like I said, you know, played a major role in the development of various religions and, you know, the warring, you know, various wars that started and stopped due to, you know, Halley's Comet or various other things in the sky.
Hmm. You tell us that among world religions, probably the strongest connection between meteorites and a religion is that of Islam. Explain what that very strong connection is.
Well, the Black Stone is probably the most venerated, you know, certainly venerated stone in Islam, and it is kind of the cornerstone in Mecca. And, you know, it has a very large, interesting history of how and what happened to that stone. It is originally said to have basically been flung down as a place to build an altar. And, of course, you know, various warring partners and events over human history have broken the stone up and displaced it and damaged it and all this you know, stuff that happens. But it is where Muslims basically face to pray is toward this stone. And you know, it's hard to know exactly its provenance as an actual rock, but all the evidence suggests that it probably was an impact that happened and then ejected that material. And that rock is actually not the meteorite itself, but is actually the ejecta from a meteorite impact that happened.
Hmm. Interesting. One of the things I really appreciate about your book is how it kind of traces the history of scientific inquiry into the nature of meteorites and whether or not they come from someplace else or if they are actually just from here on Earth somehow flung into the sky. And I guess in some ways the history of scientific inquiry is maybe a misnomer because learned people trying to understand meteorites were not in the early going really utilizing what we think of now as science. Can you just kind of briefly summarize what sort of arc of understanding we are talking about in terms of trying to come to a better understanding of what meteorites are and where they come from?
Yeah, sure. So it seems that early on, you know, in ancient, you know, ancient cultures, ancient Greece, ancient China, ancient, you know, Mesopotamia, they felt that these were coming from space. So it was fairly well documented that, you know, things were basically saying that, okay, these came from above, they came from space. And then along came Aristotle. And Aristotle actually, you know, was an incredibly smart person, of course, but he really set meteoritics back because his theory of the heavens was that they were perfect. And you had the Earth, Moon, system, and you had, you know, the planets all moving in these orders, and it was a perfect system. So you couldn't explain meteorites through that. So that really kind of set everything back for academia and people that actually were studying these things about what the actual source of these rocks falling from the sky was. And then, of course, eventually, you know, things march along. Newton comes along, you know, the best physicist of all time, and does almost the same thing and kind of sets the study of meteorites back. You know, again, there was no room for these small objects because you've got gravity that is controlling everything, and you've got the perfect motion of the planets and the perfect motion of the Earth and Moon system. There was no room for kind of the imperfection of meteorites. But luckily, you know, science prevails, and people make some very careful observations, and some chemistry is being developed, and you can see the differences in the chemistry between the Earth rocks and Moon and meteorites. And we eventually figured it out, but it wasn't until the 1800s, kind of the very early 1800s, that this really kind of became the scientific consensus that meteorites were actually objects from outer space.
Hmm. There is a moment in the book in a chapter called Ingredients for Success when you talk about the astonishment that you felt upon learning something about meteorites, namely that meteorites contained basic organic molecules, or at least some of them do. Explain why this was so astonishing to you and why this is so important in terms of understanding the significance of meteorites.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was in this cosmochemistry class in graduate school and, you know, reading one of the chapters of the book and, you know, it's talking about organics that are found in meteorites. I'm kind of like, wait, hold on, what's going on? That sounds weird. But it turns out that, you know, meteorites, certain types of meteorites that form in the outer solar system actually contain large amounts of, you know, kind of biologic precursors. And I don't just mean very simple things like, you know, alcohols or ketones. I mean, they contain amino acids. They contain, you know, parts of our DNA, you know, the base pairs of our DNA, like, you know, adenine and, you know, guanine and things like this. So, you know, they're pretty complex organic molecules that are contained in meteorites. And, you know, these end up forming these complicated molecules form in the outer solar system, and then they're basically locked into meteorites, and then the meteorites are brought to Earth. And, you know, not only just the fact that these are contained in meteorites, the importance of them is that they could have brought all of this material to Earth and created our entire biosphere. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have a lot of material falling from the sky, and it was certainly even more material falling from the sky early in Earth's history. And if you're adding that much organic material early in Earth's history, that's basically delivering all the ingredients we need for life to get started. So I think, you know, when I found that out in graduate school, it really just, like you said, just kind of blew my mind that we could have had everything we needed to create life on Earth delivered to us from the outer solar system.
Right. And, of course, just the idea that organic material can survive on an asteroid, I mean, in the deep freeze of space, it is kind of astonishing in and of itself. It reminds me of one.
And actually,
go ahead.
I'll cut in just a little bit. It's not just survive. It actually is created. So we have a lot of carbon and nitrogen and hydrogen that just exist because they're elements that exist in stars. But the way they actually form is really interesting because they kind of lock onto ices in the outer solar system. And then UV radiation, which is something that's ubiquitous in the universe, actually ends up creating these types of more complex organic molecules from these very basic building blocks of elements and molecules. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. It's not just that they survive, but they're actually created and then are delivered.
Right, because they come from someplace, and the idea of them coming from space is astounding. It reminds me of one of the best stories in the book, which is the story of a particular meteorite, which is known as Allen Hills 84001, which is a meteorite that came from the planet Mars. And when it was viewed under a telescope, it looked like it contained microfossils of perhaps organic life. I mean, microbes in this meteorite that we know came from Mars. Why don't you just take the story to the end? It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. So this is one of the rocks that was collected in Antarctica, and it was brought back, and you know, people were looking at it under microscopes, and they found something very interesting. And like you alluded to, it looks like a cellular fossil, basically. It looks like a little microbe. We have these things that look almost identical to it on Earth. And that, of course, got people very, very excited. You know, if you find life on another planet, that's a really big deal. Of course, that planet, you know, it was a chunk of a planet that came to us, but that's still the implication that life existed on Mars. And, you know, that got, obviously, the scientific community and everyone else very excited about this. It turned out that scale matters a lot. And while this looked a lot like life on Earth, it was about 100 to 1,000 times smaller than the similar types of things that we know as kind of life and cellular beings on Earth. You know, so it was something that was actually formed abiotically, so not with life. That just kind of looked very much like what we see as life today. So, you know, this obviously generated a lot of press and excitement for good reason. But it turned out that after further study, this didn't actually represent life on Mars. It was just something that could also be produced by other means other than life. But it certainly got, you know, people thinking about life on Mars and really directed our research in ways that maybe we couldn't have predicted before that happened.
Right. And, of course, it's also a good reminder that scientific inquiry, while it can be really, really exciting, also needs to be careful and cautious and sober-minded. And of course, that's part of the whole scientific process, which, of course, is also something you, along the way, really end up telling us a lot about in your fascinating book. Your book, again, is titled Impact: How Rocks from Space Led to Life, Culture, and Donkey Kong. We didn't get to Donkey Kong. We'll have to leave it to our listeners to explore that connection when they pick up your book, which is published by William Morrow and the author Greg Brenica. Greg Brenica, I loved your book, and I was so glad we could talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we talk about the RITA, namely the RITA Talent Picken Regional Center for Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We spend most of the hour with Dr. Leslie Walker, who is Dean of Arts and Humanities at Parkside. And we'll be talking about the 10th anniversary of the RITA and all of the things that are planned to commemorate that exciting anniversary. Also, you'll hear briefly from the interview I recorded 10 years ago with Dean Young, who was dean at the time of the opening of the Rita. A really fun conversation about all that it took to design and construct the Rita and all of the exciting things.